Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. How can God use a murderer to inaugurate his high priest? And what does that have to do with Yeshua, also known as Jesus? This study walks through Leviticus chapter 8, Ezekiel 44, and Hebrews 7 to unpack how guilt is transferred, why sacrificial blood perfects the altar, and why Yeshua's resurrection is essential to the whole salvation process. We'll see how Aaron's bull, Ezekiel's temple, and the Melchizedek priesthood all point to Yeshua as both priest and offering.
This is pretty straightforward subject matter as far as the inauguration of Aaron, and then of course the continue on of how that process looks to the New Testament as well as in Ezekiel. So in this process, there's a few subtle details which are kind of fundamental to Christian concepts of God and of Jesus and what his functionality was. And those things have to be understood pretty well, but most of us do. So this is not going to be a new topic or new concepts to most of you, but it's still going to be, I personally think, somewhat informative. So starting out, Leviticus 8. So with Leviticus 8, we discussed the lengthy discussion matter of how Aaron gets inaugurated as priest. Of course, also his sons as well. The details of this are spelled out earlier in Exodus 29, when God is describing to Moses what you will do, what offerings are done. And there's a few subtle things that may have caught your attention in either Exodus 29 or here where it's when they're actually physically doing it. And we'll talk a little bit about those because those are, for lack of a better term, kind of an interesting topic. Not necessarily like fundamentals of your understanding of God, but it's an interesting topic as far as how we see and how God sees different things, and of course, regarding animals and offerings. So, first of all, we'll go through this process a little quick on this end, first when it comes to the Torah portion, because we'll come back to it again as we continue on to Hebrews to retie it together. So, in this section, we have Aaron is being anointed as priests. Oh, Aaron is a priest, his sons as priests. It's a little bit weird. It's a little bit weird because normally, human beings, how human beings normally think, we typically think of, I'm going to make this individual holy. We'll call him Aaron. We'll draw up here for Aaron, my stick figures, okay? So Aaron and his two sons, I'll make them shorter. They probably weren't shorter. As you know, most sons can be taller than their dad, but that's all right. Aaron and his sons, I think it's four of them. But only two of them were actually there. So I'm putting these two in parentheses because they get done later. So Aaron and his sons, two of them initially. And normally we think, okay, I'm going to make Aaron and his sons, the priests and their continuing line. I have to start with something that is greater than them. So how we normally think of things, we say, okay, I'm going to put something that is greater, we'll put the word great up here. This thing has to be greater in order to impart a piece. We'll break a little piece here and put a piece onto Aaron and his sons. That's what we normally associate of making something which was once not holy to make it holy. So Aaron and his sons up this point are technically just secular individuals, ordinary citizens of Israel, nothing fancy or special about them per se, other than the fact that part of Levi, and Levi was designated as a priest group as a whole, and of course it's broken to individual families. But up to this point, Aaron and his sons are a fellow Israelite. That's really their primary function. Moses, the person being used, under Moses over here, who was the younger brother of Aaron, by the way. So, but Moses over here, he is acting in a role that he isn't actually fit for. And what I mean by that is that Moses is not a priest of any form. He is a prophet. He has history with living in Pharaoh's household, various activities in his life. I have no clue all the details how he was raised because we weren't around. It doesn't describe the details of everything, but it does describe some basic understanding if he was raised in Pharaoh's household. So Moses essentially is a type of mix between Israelite and Egyptian, neither of which would classify him as great, meaning holy. So I would qualify this great as being holy. So holy is the component which means set aside or separated out. Holy is the peace that God is imparting upon Aaron and his sons during this inauguration process. But God has Moses do it, which is counterintuitive. Normally, you think of somebody who's greater than Aaron and his sons, meaning more holy than Aaron and his sons in order to pull this off. We already know Moses has a past. We know he's a killer. So he has a murder charge. He's a killer. He murdered a man in Egypt. There was a trial. He saw the guy beating this other guy up. He said, I'm making a judge, jury, executioner. Done. Wham. Moving on. Right. So we already know he's not a priest for, like, for example, a sinless individual. He is an ordinary man. I realize God set him aside for a lot of things. We're not discussing this just yet. So he's already a man. Now, we're taking this man whose God is saying, Moses, you're not a priest. You're not qualified as a priest. You can't be a priest. God's going to use him as a surrogate temporary priest for a spot, a chunk of time, and take something that is greater, holy, which is a priesthood classification, and put it upon Aaron and his sons. This is not a normal way which we think of priests in the form of making something which is both Moses and Aaron start out as being secular, by the way. They're just ordinary people, babies growing up as kids in Egypt. There's nothing special or fancy about their lineage, per se, as far as how they're living. So this is an interesting scenario that God has chosen to use Moses to fill this role, because he doesn't have anybody else, obviously. But it's still an interesting problem. So God is using Moses, who actually has a murder charge on him. He never paid for, because he wasn't executed for murdering, because technically that's how the rule works. There's a murder charge on him, unpaid for murder charge. And he's put upon to fill this role for Aaron and his sons. And he fulfills it not just by physically killing the animals and doing the blood offering stuff that he's supposed to do. He's actually doing it. He's also eating the portion allocated to the priests, as if he was a priest. So in this instruction, it was recorded originally in Exodus 29, but it's being spelled out here in Leviticus 8. This instruction, there's a few animals being offered here. I'm gonna put a stick figure over here because that's why you stick figures. So we have a bull, big bull with like little tail, horns. We have a bull that's being offered. That one is offered initially for Aaron and his sons and their sin to clean, to purify them. But it has another role, which we'll talk about in a minute. And also he has a little ram. I'll put a little ram here, make him smaller. He's a puffball, because sheep are puffballs. And then you have a second one, ram. He's also puffball. They have horns. But the second one is used for the actual the eating process, that Moses eats a portion of it on the second one. These three animals are done, the process for Aaron and his sons. And this unique scenario is what's a little bit odd, in that we have somebody with a murder charge acting as a temporary surrogate high priest, or essentially a high priest, in order to impart high priest status to Aaron and, of course, priesthood to his sons, who then essentially... This sounds a little odd, but essentially the high priest overrules, or has the ability to overrule or charge, make decisions based on what is not acceptable according to Torah. That's the high priest's job. And the priests do things like that too. The high priest is his primary job. He oversees, makes sure that things are followed according to the laws of God, which at this point, Moses is doing the work. So This process, we're talking about a little bit about this, because this is where it comes very key into Christianity, how Messiah fills this part of the role. So that's why I want to bring this up. So this oddity is because it accomplishes something which is very unique. And I'm going to circle the item. It's this bull. That's the unique thing in it. And this is how the whole process fixes itself. Because you can't have a murderer normally make a high priest out of Aaron's sons. And by the way, in case you've forgotten, Aaron has a death charge on him too. He still has death charge of the golden calf, which, contrary to his claim, he made it. He didn't. It wasn't it popped out. So he already has a death charge on him by God, because he not only did he create an idol, he facilitated the worship of it in the process. So it makes it a really, really bad scenario for him. So he has his own problems over here. And God obviously did not kill him for it, but Moses had to intervene to make that happen. So there's a lot of details. We have flawed human beings. We have flawed people that have errors in their life, bad decisions being made, things that affected who they are and what they became. So we have to have this strange thing fixed, Eraser, in that this is where it gets really weird or complicated, but how Christianity mechanically, meaning legally process, how Messiah actually functions. This is how it's done, okay? So we have murder. We have people with violent charges and death charges on them, right? That's penalties of death for both these sins. Murder is a death penalty, you know, idol worship, death penalty, right? Pretty big thing. So I don't know what Aaron's sons were involved with. I assume they were part of the idol thing because it doesn't record what else they were doing. Anyway, so I erased a little bit of this because we focus a little bit upon how God fixes this problem. Because you have two people who are, technically speaking, unqualified, use the term loosely, unqualified, to do what they're actually being told to do. It's the bull that fixes it. Okay, so the bull fixes this problem. Now, you will notice in this passage what Aaron and his sons do with the bull. So I'm gonna redraw my bull with its bad feet. Okay. So remember, I'm gonna surround him with Aaron and his sons. So Aaron and his sons, the stick figure people, and there's another one. We'll just put him off the side here. They are putting their hands on the bull. In case you're not familiar with the process of putting hands on an animal, don't laugh at my stick figures. It's glory, the comedian here. All right, so put hands on an animal. The process is to impart your something, your identity, your something to the animal. That's the idea behind it. You pray over, hey, God, I'm putting this on this individual. We do that for our children. We bless them. Right? You put your hands, you bless the blessing you're saying you want to put upon that child or upon this your children. And it happens all the time, parents all the time. It's pretty normal. We expect that type of activity and the blessings that we're asking for our kids upon the child. So the same principle though is they're not asking a blessing, they're asking something else upon it because this is what we deal with sins. So Aaron and his sons. A-R-O-N. And it's we all regarding sin. That's what we're transferring. Now, this is an interesting concept. All of you have heard the idea of what we call forgiveness, right? You know what forgiveness is, right? This is an important concept because this is what's happening in this storyline, all right? So the forgiveness is, okay, it doesn't take away the flaw, the mistake. You can't unring a bell. You can't make it not happen. It doesn't do that. So everything you do, however, has a consequence, whether it's a good consequence or a bad one. We all have consequences, everything you do. Whether you choose to do something good or bad, the consequence follows out from that. Well, sin has a consequence too. It usually is either a form of a penalty being paid of some form. It could be a fine. It could be even a death penalty, for example, for some of them. So certain sins have consequences. Well, the nature of forgiveness is designed to remove the consequence of the act, whether the act happened to have been. It doesn't mean that the act never happened. It just says the consequence is removed. So when we say, okay, I'm going to transfer my sin. Let's say I pretend I did sin X, whatever sin X was, I did sin X. I'm Aaron for a minute. I put my hands on the bull. Okay, bull, you now did sin X. No, that's false. The bull didn't sin X. I did sin X. Okay. All I can say is, bull, I did sin X, but I'm putting the responsibility and the consequence from sin X upon the bull. That's the process. It's a transfer. It's pretty typically standard how this process works. We transfer things what we did. Not the act, but the consequence from it, from this to that. Forgiveness is the exact same way. I offended person A, and person A looks at me and says, Daniel, I am forgiving you I am taking away the consequence, which could be anything. What are the consequences? The guilt, the shame, the anger, whatever it has. What are the consequences having to be? The upsetness. I am taking away. I'm not going to be upset with you, Daniel, anymore because I, person A, chose to forgive you. That doesn't mean I didn't do it. It means the consequence will be removed. So when we transfer sins, a transfer, it's not that the sin itself gets transferred, it's the consequence gets transferred. The penalty that gets transferred, that's what's being transferred. Now, this is the important part. The bull obviously didn't do anything, meaning didn't do anything wrong. But let's pretend for a minute that these sins, they're now the consequence, whether a consequence of the bull, so consequence. Okay, I can't spell it, but I'll abbreviate for con. So consequence is on the bull. Now imagine you didn't do that. Imagine Aaron for a minute, since the golden calf, we'll use that example, that God said, okay, Aaron, I'm sorry, but you did it. You created an idol. You facilitated the whole process of it. You told people to come up and worship the idol. You did the entire process of everything I told you not to do. Aaron, the consequence is strictly on you, Aaron only. And let's pretend Aaron could not transfer the consequence. Well, then what, a just God, what would he do? We have to kill Aaron. Pretty straightforward. That's the only answer. If you can't transfer consequence, then Aaron must die. That's how it works. There's no really if, ands, or buts about it. So the case of if Aaron maintained the consequence, he'd have to die for it. So the transfer is how that consequence is removed from Aaron's responsibility. But Aaron's still around, not dead. So in this process of consequence being transferred, now the bulls will take the whole consequence. Ordinarily, if God had Aaron killed for the golden calf, once Aaron is now dead because the golden calf, he's no longer guilty for the golden calf. He paid for it. It's like you getting a speeding ticket, right? You got a speeding ticket. I go to the court. Here's a speeding ticket. I paid the full fine for the speeding ticket. Now, it doesn't change because it ever happened, but I'm no longer paying any more for the speeding tickets. It's done. Although the insurance, I have an issue with that. Insurance companies say, wait a minute, you got speeding tickets. But the idea is that legally, the legal system, you would no longer penalty for the speeding ticket because you paid the price. So if Aaron died for it, then it's paid for. Finished, kaput, done. Consequence paid. And the golden calf did not happen, but Aaron's no longer guilty for it because it's already finished. Well, what's the problem with that? Every human being then dies because at some point in time makes a mistake and there's a penalty for it. There's an important idea, but the important thing I want to focus on is that, remember, if Aaron in fact was killed for it, then once he's killed, he's no longer guilty in that he's now pure or perfect. That's the most critical part of this discussion. So if Aaron had died, he would then, because for the person, he'd been perfect. At that point in time, the blood that was his blood would have been guiltless, completely perfect for that crime. It's been done. But now we transfer the bull. So this bull, this consequence of the bull, once the bull dies, pays for it, hit the bull's blood is now perfect, guiltless, flawless. It's been paid for. And this is how the strange anomaly that our Bible talks about is actually functional. Because the bull's blood here is not just for Aaron and his sons. What did Moses do with it? There's a big altar that the bull is burned up on. But most importantly, the blood of the bull is put on the altar, making the altar perfect. Up to this point, the altar was an altar. It's not holy. It's just an object. Like a rock, a stone, a piece of metal. It's of no value. But now that you have a perfect offering, the bull, because it now paid for it, it's now a perfect thing, a holy thing. It is now usable to transfer perfection to the altar. Hence, the altar becomes atoned. That's how it becomes perfect. That's the process the mechanism works, because it is counterintuitive to our brains to say, wait a minute, I, Aaron or Daniel, whatever, I transferred my guilt to this animal. Now the animal should be, in my mind, contaminated, dirty, gross, icky, because the consequence is on the animal. Now the animal, I think, well, now I'm going to kill the animal and I use its blood, which in my mind says it's dirty, it's gross, it's icky. it's the consequence. I mean, it's blood, the dirty, gross, icky blood, to make an altar clean. That can't function. That's not possible. That's backwards. It's like taking human feces and dumping on your plate so the plate's clean. That's gross. You can't do that. That's disgusting. It wouldn't work because the death process is what makes the blood perfect or pure. This is an important idea how we understand this. This is how the mechanism by which Jesus functions as our high priest. This is the only way it actually works. If it didn't work this way, we'd all be up a creek. So this is an important idea. Now, the problem with the bull process is a bull only dies one time, right? You can't. So he does this, altar gets cleaned, purified, Aaron's being, you know, inaugurated as the high priest, all hunky-dory, everything's great, but bad things, people do bad things later. And here's the problem, I'm out of the blood. I used it. I can't store it for forever. The bull's blood ain't gonna live for thousands or millions of years. It's in a bowl for a little while, and it gets poured out, it doesn't last long. So eventually another sin comes along, or transgression comes along, some mistake comes along, and now the altar is now contaminated again. I am back to my original problem. This is where the Apostle Paul was discussing in Hebrews that this is a never-ending cycle. It doesn't permanently fix this process. I have to continuously offer more animals to clean the thing every so often. In this case, actually, the Bible says once a year for atonement. But I had to do this regular process to re-clean it because it doesn't keep it clean. This transfer, the consequence, even though it made the bull's blood perfect, that bull's blood is now usable to clean any of the items in the temple, whether it be the showbread, whether it be the bull itself, the ark, anything can be cleaned this way, because once guilt's been transferred and the item that was transferred died, that was now the purest, most perfect, spiritually speaking, form it can ever be. That is the best, cleanest it could possibly be. And that's how it transfers purity or sanctity or sanctuary or holiness, set asideness to other things around it. That's the mechanism process. So, hopefully this makes sense so far, because it's going to be expanded in our book of Hebrews in greater detail. But in this discussion matter we have before we go to Hebrews, because there's things we'll cover here in Leviticus first. So now we understand hopefully a little bit about the counterintuitiveness of how an animal's blood can somehow miraculously make something else, which is an inanimate object or even a human being, clean or pure. That's how the process works. It's once it's paid for, the blood now becomes pure, because now it's perfect. I mean, he has committed and is guilty of nothing anymore. That's how the process works. So we have the inherent discussion of ours, which we'll get to in Hebrews in a minute, when it comes to humanity continues on to fail. We continue on to make mistakes, you know, this process. Yes, Lori has a question. You're cool. What kind of sin is this for? Oh, yeah. So she asked, what kind of sin is this one for? So this first of all, this is a bull. So it's specific to high priests. I believe kings, I think, also offer bulls. Don't quote me for exactly off my head. I'm not positive. And mostly really wealthy individuals use bulls. People in charge of people, commanders, people in charge of it. We have other animals for other people. You got, as I meant by fluffy rams I drew, we have other animals for other types of sins and transgressions. But, and the altar itself gets purified with goats also during the Day of Atonement. So it has its times, so it has to repeat purification. But each time the laying on of hands is the mechanism, the process of transfer, not of the sin, but the penalty or guilt of the sin is transferred over, so that when it dies, it's now pure or perfect. That's the only penalty. Well, okay, so she asked if that's the only penalty for the sin you did. It's not that there can't be other like natural consequences of something you did. That we're not discussing that. We're discussing something that is holy or spiritual. So the issue here is, her question is about other types of sins that may, you know, maybe beyond, this just doesn't fix everything, right? It fixes things on the form of what God is focused on. What God's focus on is the altar, the offerings going on it, and the individuals offering things. That does not fix other mistakes that this doesn't pay for. So here's a good example, okay? Aaron's two sons who get burned by God, okay? He didn't give them the opportunity to offer an animal to fix the problem. They brought the foreign fire. I don't know where the fire was from. People debate what that's about. Brought the foreign fire, and God said, you're too close to me. That's wrong. And he just burned him alive. So there's some consequences, some sins that this doesn't cover. We're not discussing sins that are that this doesn't cover. Those sins are still other consequences. And I can't speak to all of them. I can't speak to all of them. I know obviously Aaron's sons are guilty of a sin that this didn't cover. To be fair, they did all these offerings ahead of time, but still, it didn't cover those. We also have other examples where this sins, this process does not cover them either. There's what we call sin unto death, as I think Messiah said it. Forgive me who quoted it. The sin unto death and sins not unto death. Sins unto death, the consequence is still there. There's actually a death penalty required for certain consequences, and there's no way around those. But spiritually speaking, there is. So let's say, for example, a human being, a murderer A, all right, killed person B. It's a murderer, okay? If murderer A pays for that sin, meaning being executed for the sin, the guilt, the penalty for murder B is now paid for, right? He's not going to be re-killed again. and again, because it's just done. Yeah, the justice is paid for. It's not that you can't kill a person over and over and over and over and over again. It doesn't work that way. So when it comes to penalties, there are certain penalties in the death that you have to go through, and that's between you, God, and your relationship with God, and of course the legal local authorities of whatever you did. She has a verse here. Says 1 John 5 verses 16 through 17. I do not have that memorized, so sorry about that. Sin unto death, that's a sin unto death, right? It's for the death. I think it is. Well, I'm gonna look it right now. Anyway, so some consequences you have to deal with those penalties that do come. So, we're discussing generic sins we're dealing with. So we're not discussing necessarily ones that are penalties to death. These are more ordinary ones. Meaning, for example, let's say ordinary sin that's not to death. Lusting after your neighbor's wife. Oop, don't do that. Can't do that. Stop. Oop, mistake. Can you undo it? No, you already did it. There's a problem. You had a thought in your mind. This is a problem. This is an issue that you did. You can't undo. You can't go reverse in past to make that not happen. But it's still sin. You may have repented. God, I'm sorry. Avert my eyes. You better job. Blah, blah, blah. That doesn't fix the fact you already did it. So that's what these types of things are for. The ones are not designed for death. Inadvertently making a mistake on Shabbat, what you should have done. Not out of rebelliousness, but inadvertently. Oops. That's the type of sin we're talking about here. We're not discussing the ones that blaspheme God, for example. That's not an inadvertent. You did it on purpose, and guess what? There's a consequence for that. So this type of sins we're dealing with on this topic. Hold on, it makes a little bit of sense. Okay, move forward a little faster here. So let's move forward a little bit. So we got, I won't cover all the details of the burnt offerings, but there are certain offerings being listed here. You will notice that I mentioned earlier when I started out that Moses acts as a temporary surrogate high priest during this process. And you will see that on the second ram, there's two rams being killed. The second ram, I'll put his fluffy, body here. I'm sure rams do not like being called fluffy, but he has ramming horns, pigtails. So, Fluffy Ram, he is, oh, there it is. So you paste the quotation. If anyone sees his brother or sister committing a sin, not leading to death, he shall ask God, and God will, for him, give life to those who commit sin, not leading to death. There is sin leading to death, and I'm not saying that he should ask about that. All unrighteousness is sin, and there is sin not leading to death. So yeah, these are sins not leading to death what we're focusing on here. Thank you for the quotation. I appreciate that. So the case of the ram, there's a unique thing that takes place, the ram, which we'll talk a little bit about it. I'm going to erase my bowl for a minute because we discussed the transfer of guilt. The ram, there's a few things you pay attention to it because this is how, again, an element that is of what caught my attention, maybe it catches yours, catches my attention. So the ram is cut up into pieces and parts, the second ram. He's got, we'll have thighs, and you have the two that are being focused on is the thigh and the breast. So obviously the back leg or something, or the breast fight. Now you will know in our, you remember in our Torah, There's rules about thighs from the Genesis, and that because Jacob had his hip socket dislocated, that there's a section or a piece of the all animals that Israelites will not eat. That is forbidden out of honor for their father Jacob. So there's a thigh part there, but it's not the entire thigh, just a chunk of a piece near the socket, the sinew near the socket. They avoid that part. But in this case, normal in this second ram offering, if you'll notice, it actually matches for the most part the peace offerings we discussed in Leviticus 3, as far as how you handle them, what you do with them, and that the thigh and the breast normally go to the priest to eat. That's part of his portion of the animal. In this instance, the way that this was broken about, the breast is given to Moses as if he was a priest. He's not, but he's presumably a priest. And the thigh, along, which is normally the priest, is not this case, along with some bread, and there's some oil in the bread, everything else, they are burned up on the altar. So these thigh and the bread, they wind up going straight to the altar, get burned up. And those of you who don't know differences between wave offerings and heave offerings, just because a little quick, this is in your Bible, you have the heave offering and wave offering. It's like, okay, so what? Some piece gets, they do something weird with it, right? That's what it looks like. Okay, so it's directional. That's all it really is. So Shmo A, he has an animal he's offering. It's a wave offering. So the animal comes, Shmo grabs a piece of the animal or the whole thing or some part of it, whatever. In this case, normally it's the thigh and the breast, grabs a piece of it, and the priest grabs also. But they're holding each other. They're both holding it with their hands. And they literally wave side to side, side to side. It is a very visual transfer of going from Shmo A to priest B over here. It's a side transfer. That's all it really is. There's nothing really fancy about it. It's like, oh, the wave offering. Yeah, it's you're waving it side to side. It's important you don't wave it up and down. It's side to side only, all right? It's a transferring from this person to the priest. The priest is taking ownership of this item, which they now get to eat later. In the case of heave offerings, it's not side to side. The priest takes it, goes up and down. And that is mean that this item is going up to God or coming down from God. It's a heave offering. Heave offerings usually are burned up because they go up in smoke. Wave offerings are not. They're usually eaten. And so normally on a peace offerings, not this one, that the breast and the thigh are both wave offerings. So they would go from the person to the priest doing the officiation process. They're going side to side. It sounds silly, but that's what they do. God wrote it. He has his reasons. But in the case, normally the thigh goes that way, but it doesn't. In this one, it went to a wave offering, wave sideways, like from Aaron to Moses. But then Moses put it on the altar and made it go up in the altar to burn it. So he converted this wave offering, we'll put a little wave here, wave offering into a heave offering by putting it on the altar and burning it. So, and God commanded him to do so. So, okay, God, that's what you want to do. That's what we do it. As far as if you try to look up explanations as to why, you know, theologians have this theory and that theory, they are truly clueless because there's no reason we don't know why. It just is. It doesn't describe the Bible, so it does not explain why. But we do know that Moses is acting as a semi priest. He's not actually a priest, not actually a high priest. He's semi, he's a surrogate, he's filling in. So he's not actually getting everything, he's getting just a piece of it. And this is where the theologians kick in and say, well, because Moses received the breast and not the thigh, they associate they, who the they is, you can debate this, but people, meaning both Jewish and Christian theologians and secular scholars think this, they all agree on this part, the thigh has something to do with strength or power. If you notice the animal, when they jump, they typically, four-legged animals, use their hind legs to propel them up. The front legs go up and the hind legs propel them over something. It's usually associated as strength or power. So the idea being, this is how they associate, how they write their articles and arguments about this, that the thigh was not given to Moses because Moses is not worthy of the power that this thing has, but rather it goes up to God instead. Yeah, you could debate that's right or wrong. I'm not going to argue them. They're just guessing. But it's still there, and God did have this spelled out. So it transfers it. The one wave offering normally goes to the priest. This piece of it, the thigh, goes up in smoke instead. So it turns from a wave offering to a heave offering, and in this one instance. That's not normal, but that's how it's done. So I won't go through all the different animals and who eats what, because that's probably beyond our scope of discussion today. Because I want to jump into this, because this will get a little complicated. Hopefully I can cover this clearly. Hopefully I didn't mess you up so far. So you have some animals being offered. We have the breast and thigh being divided out abnormally because Moses is not actually the priest. And we also discussed the transfer of how an animal becomes pure or perfect, the most holy thing there is, meaning spiritually holy, not physically, to how it transfers to holiness to the altar. And this is how, we'll talk about Jesus in a minute, how that process works. But I have to erase this temporarily because I had to cover Ezekiel just a little bit and how Ezekiel's tied into this. I think my altar up. So Ezekiel's section talks about characters or individuals. Now I realize it ended in verse 8 of Ezekiel 44. If you finish off the rest of the chapter, it explains a little more what's going on because it's still confusing initially. But Ezekiel 44, actually like 43 through like 46, there's a man called the prince. So the prince, I'll write a prince up here. I don't claim to know who this guy is. I don't. I'm not claiming. He doesn't look like Jesus. He's not a high priest, but he's like a funky blend of both, right? But not complete. He's a human being with kids and, like, you know, we assume he has a wife. He has sons, so he has a wife somehow. So this individual prince is allowed to offer offerings that only high priests can do, but not all offerings, just some of them. So he's not truly high priest. He's like partial, okay, like a semi-high priest, semi-not. And he is also in charge, like a Messiah would be in charge, but only in Jerusalem, or more accurately, the temple itself. There's not much else he gets to do. So he's like a semi-Messiah, semi-not. And so there is yet to, I've never heard of a very good explanation of this individual. But there's people theory and their ideas, but they're not very good, in my opinion. So the prince, he offers animals and he has this process of offering things up. And we also discuss in Ezekiel 44, discusses individual characters. They're called Levites. And Levites and Israelites, these two categories in Ezekiel 44, there's a problem in that God is dividing out the Levites in two grouped categories. One group that accepted idols or offerings to idols, and one group that did not accept offerings to idols. So remember, our altar being pure, right? It has to be a pure altar. So Levites are grouped into two different categories, and God's going to divide. I'm not getting rid of you. I'm dividing you up. So I'm saying, okay, Levites, well, Levite group one and Levite group two. So these two categories, Levite group two, you're still around, but you are stuck at the North Gate. And your job is to make sure nobody unclean, uncircumcised, comes into the temple. That's their only job. They don't get to serve in the temple because they were unfit because they accepted offerings to idols on God's behalf. Arab, we don't do that, right? Levite group number two, they get to stay inside because they chose to not offer offerings to idols on God's behalf. They chose not to. So God divides them up into these two categories and says, hey, don't make this mistake anymore. This is not cool. I'm not killing you off, but these are important things to say, hey, you don't cross these boundaries. Because if you did, if God accepted the group number two, which is has a history of accepting offering to idols, they are contaminated. What animals will clean them and clean the altar they're using? Well, nothing. They're perpetually making the altar unclean. Because themselves are unclean. It's a never-ending cycle. So he can't have them in the altar room to do the actual offerings because everything they do is by default unclean. It's like, again, my plate of poop, right? Here's my priest group number two. I have poop on them all the time. They can't wash themselves, right? Imagine that. So that's a job. You want them on God's altar? No, you don't. You can't get clean. It's permanently stuck that way. So God said, I'm not killing you off. I'm just isolating you to give you a remedial task to filter out anybody who doesn't belong. That is your functional job. And we have the prince who gets his own personal gate, the East Gate. He gets to eat and such. And he gets a fellowship with God. I'm not going to talk about the eating with God yet. That's beyond our discussion today, because it's really interesting, actually. When you eat with God, you fellowship with him. But that's a whole other category of discussion. And that's also Leviticus 6, 7, and 8. Five. Anyway, it's like four or five chapters are discussing who gets to eat what. And that's really, really fascinating by itself. But we will discuss that today. So the prince sees a lot of things that they can't do. So God divides him up because one side, Levite group number one, they're able to work in the temple and offer offerings. Levite group number two is not, because there isn't an offering available to purify them. What they've done was deliberate. They deliberately chose to offer idols, sacrifice idols for God's behalf. That wasn't like I had no idea. This was a deliberate choice. And as we have deliberate sins have deliberate consequences and permanent consequences, which it's not a sin to death, as this isn't a death penalty sin, because I'm not going to kill you for it, but you're dirty and I can't accept you because you're dirty. If that makes sense, I'm going to lose anybody on that. Now, we have this whole offering process that is complicated, a little bit difficult to understand at times, but how we transfer purity or pure blood onto an altar from an animal that isn't really guilty of anything, but it gets pays a consequence. Now we have this unique scenario going on with Messiah in, I have enough time? Ooh, short. I'm going to be short here. In Hebrews. So let's jump to Hebrews real quick, because this is going to be a more value added discussion. So my other book out, Hebrews chapter 7. Sorry, I have a bookmark on here somewhere. There it is. Hebrews 7. So in Hebrews 7, Paul's having a really interesting argument, a discussion matter, I should say. And so he's discussing an inherent flaw with this system, is that, as I mentioned before, you have Levite group number two, that there isn't an offering that makes them pure enough to offer on the altar. God says, you just can't do it. Well, and Paul's point about all of them are. Every priest is a human being, and you clean an altar up and it doesn't stay clean because next week or next month he does something wrong. Well, what now, where are you at? You didn't fix anything. It's the same exact problem. It's a repetitive, continuous, never-ending cycle. This is dumb. It's not working. So Paul's discussing that this is an inherent flaw. It's not that it doesn't functionally work. God didn't make a mistake, but humans make the mistakes. It doesn't make it. It's not persistent. It doesn't consistently stay clean. So this is where Apostle Paul was discussing about how to deal with this problem, that it doesn't actually stay clean. So I erase these people because we're not discussing them anymore right now. We're leaving my altar picture up. So in this case, you have this discussion matter that Apostle Paul is trying to argue. This is to this Melchizedek priesthood category. So you will note that in our Bible, in the book of Genesis, Melchizedek is brought up. He's a guy, I'll just call him M, because he's a really difficult spelled name. So M, he shows up. There's no priest associated with him, meaning he was not anointed. He wasn't inaugurated. He wasn't, there's no ritual that's recorded. And not saying he was not inaugurated or didn't go through ritual. It's just not recorded. Who knows what he was? It's the debate, and no one understands it all because it's not recorded. So, however he became priest of it during his day, it's whatever that was, and we don't know what it is. Whatever it is, it's not according to the Torah, because the Torah doesn't discuss it. They'll discuss about Levi and Aaron. So this guy, we'll call him Mel. So Mel becomes a priest, and he's his own set of rules that no one knows. And this is where, David comes in and how Paul talks about it, that this rule that no one understands, because it's not written down, this is the Melchizedek, the rule book. So we'll call it Mel's rules. Mel's rules, whatever they were, that's the sequence why Jesus gets to be the priest, or a priest of some form, not of the Levite side, but of some other form. So Mel's rules, which Mel got from God. We don't know what the rules are, but there's something. So Mel's rules is a methodology which Jesus becomes a priest, because obviously Aaron and this whole never-ending cycle is not working really well with the bull that gets killed once and do it again and then again, and as year and years and years and years go by, never-ending cycle. And the idea is that, okay, I have this scenario. I mentioned before the bull, when he is killed, look at the bug, big horns. When a bull's killed, for being guilty, right? Not that he's sinning, but guilty. He, at that point in time, his blood is perfect, right? Perfect in every way. And the high priest, the man over here usually doing it, in the killing process, he is imparting the guilt. So the high priest is the man, the human being who outlives the bull, meaning the bull pays the penalty. Instead of the man keeps on living. So he keeps living his life. He can make choices later on. That's because the bull can't, he's dead. So the bull's process, in the blood process, in the Jesus's case, essentially what he did, and this is the key point of the resurrection, how this process needed to work, is that Jesus, symbolically speaking, inserts himself as a bull, as the bull, or as the animal. This doesn't have to be a bull, it could be any animal. Inserts as the animal temporarily. Symbolically inserted as the animal. So then the process, the guilt, when you go see Jesus tells a lot of people, you know, you're forgiven in his ministry. You talk about talking to the women and the men and purify, cleaning people up. They're healing the sick and the blind and the lame and the forgiving of sins and all these things. He was doing this stuff, right? Well, you can't do that without God's authority to do so. That's the process. You have to have God's permission. So Jesus is doing this stuff. And in the process of doing that, he's essentially giving them a guiltless scenario. So whatever sin he told, I can't remember what he told the blind guy, go and sin no more. Or the woman said to sin no more. He told the blind guy to stop sinning. It doesn't matter. The point is he told him to stop sinning. And the idea is that he didn't make the sins not happen. That's a past. You can't undo the past. What he did is he took the consequence from them and took them off the individual. Now he's holding on to them, of course, because there's a called consequence. Somebody's got to pay for it. So he has, okay, I took your guilt, not the action, but your guilt. I'm going to hold on to it. Pretend I'm Jesus. I'm holding on to it. And I'm holding my hands, and now I'm piling in more people, and the guy over there, and the girl over there, and in this, I'm piling the guilt up here, right? I'm not taking the sin, just the guilt. So he's holding on this guilt. Well, he's doing it, so he's going to either A, trans the guilt to something else, which a high priest could do, which he's not a high priest, so he can't do that. All he gets to do is transfer it to himself because he took it. He did it. He gets to transfer it. So he transfers it to himself. It's not the sort of sin. It's a penalty for the sin he's transferring. He didn't commit the sins. He didn't sleep with a bunch of guys. He didn't go off and pillage and destroy stuff. None of that stuff. But the guilt he took, not the sin of the guilt. So instead of the high priest, which normally transfers guilt to the bull, Jesus becomes the bull temporarily, or the ram, or what do you want, whatever symbol animal you want to use, to make a difference. The way he's coming because he transferred the guilt instead of to something else, he's doing it to himself. It's a transfer of almost a wave sheaf, transfer it from that person to himself. And that process, now then he dies, right? His blood spilt and he's killed for sin and such. In the process of dying, just like the bull, the process of dying, now your blood, Jesus, becomes pure. It's pure. At that point, once he dies, the blood is now pure. It's perfect in every imaginable way because it's just like the bull was. Now it can be used to purify anything it touches. That's his job. Anything the blood Jesus would then apply to would now be pure, but it could be guiltless or no longer penalty for it. Now here's the funny thing, or I find funny. Maybe you don't, but I find it funny. See, the bull gets to do it one time. Right? The bull lives, it dies, the blood spilled, it spilled the altar, it's done once. My internet's breaking up over here. So it's done one time, and then the altar is clean, the pea person's clean, the priest clean, until next week or next day when they make some of the later mistake. Well, in the case of Jesus, if he just died and that was it, he'd be the exact same scenario as the bull. Useless. It lasts one time. It's of no value because the next week everybody screws up again and does something dumb, right? It would require that same person, the bull or Jesus, to come back and apply again, meaning to reuse this blood it was used in and clean again and again and again and again. The never-ending cycle of his one-time shot that is continuously used to re-clean the altar and the person offering, not sins of death, but other regular sins. So Jesus is temporarily doing this. And this part I think is pretty, this is more beautiful, in that because Jesus isn't an animal, he's actually a man, a person who can think, right? He can make decisions for his own and make reasonable thought processes and rational thoughts and trust in God. So Jesus temporarily becomes a bull, he dies, and now he has this imaginary, this symbolic course, imaginary basin of blood, right? There's a release of blood that is his blood. It's not physical. We're using imagination, okay? And it can be used at any point in time perpetually because it doesn't go away. The only reason it doesn't go away is because he got resurrected. That's how it doesn't go away. That's the only way it doesn't go away. If he had died like all other men, it goes away. But being resurrected, he gets to take the bull's position and the priest's position and shove them into one single person. He is both the animal and the priest at the same time. That's how the Melchizedek priesthood is supposed to function. It's how our new eternal priesthood system functions. It goes forever because he's both the animal that has a one-time blood thing, but also he comes back. So now as a resurrected, he gets to reapply the blood again and again and again and again. And it's his own blood he's doing. So he took the high priest's job, which is transferring it. He transfers it. Obviously, he dies. Because God resurrected him, he now has the ability to continue on the transfer process, to continue on this wave sheaf offering, so to speak. And it's the way how it transfers from person A to person B. That's why I want to describe the wave sheaf offering, because there's a transfer process from one guy to the other guy. So the penalty is transferred over that way. And this never-ending cycle is the legal mechanism our Torah allows to make Jesus function in this way. Does that make sense? It's a legal aspect of it. I realize this is more of an esoteric discussion matter because nobody focuses on the legal aspects of it. But legal acts do matter because God is legal. a court system, right? You can, exactly. Yeah, how is he covering it? He can cover, but Jesus, you died, years ago, long before I was born. How can you cover me? That doesn't work, right? Because you've been dead for thousands of years, and it doesn't make any sense. These sins come later. It's the resurrection that makes that happen. It's the only way it can happen. And that, so he becomes a bull, never-ending cycle of this animal that's being offered for these sins and on to death. There are regular sins being offered for it. That's how he continues to purify, because the bull can keep purifying. Unlike the bull that can't, the actual animal that can't actually make choices, can't decide, say yes or no. That's why he's also the priest that gets to make those decisions. He is the priest that says, yes, I'm picking this animal. Obviously, in this case, was himself. That's why it's this legal mechanism. It may sound odd, but God is very critical on how things are done and why they work. And this is why Jesus' offering and high priest combo with blood as his own blood and also priest. That's how it works. That's the method. This is the way in which his blood offering one time actually does cover people's sins that he haven't even born yet. It's a future thing because it's a never ending thing. As long as he's resurrected, that works. If he wasn't resurrected, we're all up a creek and we're done for. There's nothing else. There's no temple offering anyway. So that's really a critical part, that God actually resurrected Jesus to make this happen. Else we'd be up a creek. But hopefully it makes a little bit of sense. Did I lose anybody? Hopefully I didn't lose anybody. And my time's, it's a little, it's a little bit late there, I think. 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock, four. Okay, maybe it's a bit of time. Any questions so far? I realize you guys over in Hell Fellowship are muted, so he has to unmute you. Did I lose anybody on this topic? Because there's a few more details I can flesh out here if I have any questions. One of them was the daily offerings that Jesus doesn't have to offer. He does offer, just not sin ones. Any questions or comments so far? Good. So the case of the Melchizedek priest. Did I ask a question? Go ahead, unmute yourself or unmute you and you. Oh, listen, go ahead.
How does the resurrection equal perpetual cleansing? I'm a bit confused by that.
Okay. So let's erase this real quick. So the cleansing process, I'm going to draw characters up here, my stick characters. My marker is getting dry. I have people up here, right, and they do some sin, some transgression, some problem, something that takes place. Well, in order to be cleansed, meaning not sin-free, but rather guilt-free, meaning no penalty being associated with it, in order to be cleansed from that guilt, that penalty, something, someone, something has to pay for it. It's like I mentioned before, like getting a speeding ticket, right? Something has to pay for it. Oh, thank you, new marker.
and pay for it. So if I have a high priest, we'll put a high priest over here. We'll put a big HP for high priest. In a normal Torah set, you, whatever guilt you did, the main difference is it was, what a guilt was, is that there's prescriptions, whether it's going to be a grain offering, there's various other animals. You can do doves, you can do sheep. What are the offerings in order to cover the particular sin that you did? And it will vary depending on what the sin, there's different levels, different consequences for certain sins are vary from one to the other. They aren't all the same. So normally you would bring your little animal, I'll bring a little animal here, and I'd offer bring the priest would obviously, I'd have to confess, which I'm putting hands the animal out loud. I'm saying what the sin is for in the hearing of the high priest who's listening to me. Technically, it could be any priest. It has to be a high priest. A priest is there. And they're hearing all the sins you're talking about. They're hearing the whole, you're confessing the whole works. Don't hide anything back because it ain't going to work otherwise. So they're hearing it all, right? And they're listening to you and you're laying your hands and you're transferring the guilt to this animal. This is how it would normally have prior to Jesus, normally would have worked. Then the high priest or any priest takes the animal as a sin offering. They slaughter it. It's divvied up in different ways. Certain parts get eaten, certain parts get burned up. And that's how then you'd be guilt-free of that particular sin. That's how that process would normally work. Okay, that makes sense. We understand that's what Torah describes. It's pretty self-explanatory as it describes how this process works. Until you come to sin, another sin again, and you do this a process again. Usually, most people understand about once a year, maybe once every 6 months. Usually once a year is pretty common to have this cycle go through in your life. You'd list your sins out for the year. Here's what they are. Here's the animal. Transfer. We move on. Life continues. The problem with this scenario, which Apostle Paul discusses, is that the high priest, also or any priest, has the sins themselves. So we'll put this in sin, their own sin problems. Well, you transferring your sin to the animal and the animal being slaughtered by the priest, well, that doesn't do much any good because the priest is already dirty. The priest has his own sins to pay for. How is he accepting mine and paying, for helping me cover my sins when he himself has his own to do or deal with? As I mentioned before, it's like the dirty plate. This would not make you clean. The high priest is just as guilty. We have an example of that with Eli and his two sons, recorded in first part of 1 Samuel. Discusses the nature of what Eli was doing and his sons. His sons were corrupting the women at the temple and also making incorrect choices for meat they weren't supposed to be eating, and various other things they were doing that was invalidating the offerings people were giving. So all the sins the priests were doing was invalidating the cleansing of the people. And God said, I'm going to kill you for it, which he did. So a priest has a lot of ability to invalidate this sin offering that this person over here offered, the animal the person offering. And that's the inherent flaw with it. Every priest has their ups and down days. Whether you did something right or wrong that day, there's various reasons why a priest may make a mistake in a given day. So this whole process doesn't work very well because it's a continuous to do it again and again and again. If the priest happened to be dirty that particular day, did something wrong that particular day, while Joe Schmo over here, we call him Schmo, he doesn't know that. He doesn't know what the priest did that day. He has no idea if the priest is guilty or not guilty. The priest isn't confessing. So in this instance, he wouldn't know the fact his sin is not forgiven because the priest was dirty. The priest can't take something in payment for Shmo's sin when the priest himself is also sinned. He's also dirty as well. So the priest's job is to clean himself up first before he deals and accepts sins or offerings from other people. So if he doesn't, Joshua doesn't know, Joshua thinks his guilt is paid for, and Joshua thinks incorrectly. It's not. And Israel will, his life will be continued as if it was never paid for. So this is an inherent flaw of human or males or human beings being priests in this scenario, because you never know when your sin's paid for. You really have no idea. You might think it, you might hope it, you pray about it, but you don't know because the priest is dirty, then your sin was dirty to begin with. Because all the priest does by killing the animal, he's sin, he just transferred not just your condition, but his own. His own is now touching the animal. And it wasn't confessed. He didn't say, hey, I'm Joe Schmo. Yeah, when you finish your list, I'll do mine on your same animal. That doesn't work because he refuses to do his own animal. So he's dirty. He's dirty to touch it. So this is where the breakdown takes place. And now when it comes to Messiah's resurrection, is that's what makes it functionally work. So I'm going to erase Shmo's name. I'll put this whole person, I'm putting Shmo and the animal in the same box, okay? And so this box is called Messiah, right? And then I'll put a new person over here. We'll pull, you know, Shmo B. The other guy, his brother. So Shmo B comes along and he has an offering. He's a sin. He's committed. Now, there's obviously their priests are currently gone. There's no temple to do this type of stuff with. So he has to deal with his sin, the consequence of it, some method. Well, in the case of Messiah, the option he has is because the bull or the animal in this case, he offered himself, took the position of an atoning tool. So the animal's blood is an atoning tool. So blood is for atoning. Hey, that job, which used to belong to animals, now, because Messiah took the temporary place of it, the animal's blood, use a quote, blood, is now transferred to Messiah's blood, right? We understand that's something complicated about that. Well, now you have a single individual who contains both the human man's thoughts, so the man, he can think, he can reason, he can talk God, and he's a man, and he's also the blood combo or built into it. So he has his blood that isn't the animal's blood, it's also stuck inside. That is now pure or perfect, okay? The blood process, the only reason there's tones is because the blood has to be perfect. We purchase to transfer guilt to it and then kill it. That makes it perfect. So he built into both the same individual, which gives the man, the Jesus, as well as the blood that was offered for him. So we've combined a pure thing, the blood, into a human being. Obviously he's dead and resurrected, a human being who has the thought process to say, yes, I will apply your guilt transfer, Shmo B, to this animal correctly. I will apply it correctly like a priest should. I don't have to apply my own. I'm accepting, I'm hearing, Shmo B, I'm hearing through your mouth the confession and the issues you have, the guilt you have. I'm hearing them, Shmo B, from your mouth. I, man, blood, Messiah combo, I am applying them to this particular blood yet again, as if it was your offering, your animal originally. So in this, if Messiah was not resurrected, meaning he could no longer make those choices, because when you're dead, you're dead, right? You don't think, there's no thoughts of the grave, you're dead. So if he wasn't resurrected, he wouldn't be able to say to Shmo B, spiritual or physical, any other methods, yes, I am applying your sin to this animal, this my blood. You couldn't do it because he's dead. Well, being resurrected means he's not dead. So now he can make those transfers saying, yes, God, I'm taking this Joe Schmo's B's guilt. I'm also applying it with the same blood I did before. I'm reusing it because the blood in this case, because it's Messiah's blood, it doesn't decompose. It doesn't go away. It's always in his possession. It's kind of a strange way of thinking, but this is how this process is designed to work, in that we've combined, God combined the animal's pure blood into Messiah at the same time as Messiah has the human mind to think, reason, and talk to God and make decisions after, before and after he's dead, because he's got resurrected. So he's allowed to continuously make the choices. I'm going to apply this to this Joe Shmo B's sin or guilt. Again, I'm going to apply it as well. That resurrection was a key function. You run across that in Romans chapter 1. And Apostle Paul points out, the resurrection is everything. The death was not that, it was important, but that wasn't the key point. It's a resurrection. In Romans 1, Paul says, that's how it works. Romans 1, 3, that this, the resurrection was the key crux of this whole entire book that Paul's writing in Romans. Is all about the resurrection makes this system work. If he wasn't resurrected, there's nothing. There's nothing here that makes it, but there's nothing to actually transfer. The blood would only pay one time only 2,000 years ago. It's of no value anymore. So the resurrection is how this process is supposed to work. That's what Apostle Paul is trying to argue throughout his entire book. His introductory discusses. This is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the resurrection and how this process transferred, how this whole system is supposed to work now with this non-Levitical priesthood, because we have one guy that embodies both. the animal offering and the priest in a single combo, so that he can now continuously do this without having to die again and again and again, because he already died one time. So that's essentially the crux of Paul's argument, that the resurrection was the key tool that allows this to perpetually continue on as generations go on and on and on and on and on well after Jesus died. If it wasn't resurrected, we'd be stuck the exact same scenario we're back with Aaron, that you killed it once and it paid for one time, and now it's no value because the guy's dead. You can't do it again. The same thing as the bull would have had, or Aaron's inauguration process would have had. This is the core of what Paul's trying to argue. I realize he was just doing one chapter of his book, Romans, but he's trying to prove his premise that the resurrection is how this process works. I don't know if I helped, and I'll probably make it more complicated for you. I apologize, but I'm trying to explain it. Anything else I can try it to explain?
That was extremely helpful.
Oh, good.
And then just to clarify, that you said that Yeshua, when he was healing people all the time, he was taking on not their sin, but the guilt of their sins during that time.
Right.
Even. And then he died and he rolled it all in like a rebus of some kind. And then atone, right?
It's sort of, yeah, because you can't, because you and I both know, if I commit a sin, I can't make the sin not happen. I can't go back as if it never occurred. It did in fact happen. My mind does not forget it. Paul was arguing about the we don't have conscience of sin. That's not true. We do have conscience of sin. We always have conscience of sin because we're human beings. We're alive. So ideally we wouldn't, but reality is we don't undo the sin. The way which I forgot the passage, forgive me for the address, but it was that he lived and he died for our sins. He became sin for us. It's not how she phrases. He died for sin. He was killed because of sin for us. That's his functionality. When Jesus had told the people, now I'm taking your ailment or your illness or whatever it is away, until now go sin. He's telling them to stop sinning now. Discontinue. That these ailments, these problems you have are a consequence, not all of them, mind you, but it's the ones he talked about, are a consequence of the life of your bad choices or your parents' choices or somebody's choices. Somebody made an error along the way. Well, it's all back to Adam and Eve. Someone made an error along the way that caused degradation of humanity and your behaviors. And so these are important things. And now God, Jesus would say, okay, I'm taking the guilt away from you. Not that you didn't sin, you did. So the penalty away from you. So the penalty is I'm holding your penalty in my hand, but you now to just stop doing that anymore. Discontinue your behavior. Move on to a more positive way. As James had argued, said, hey, you can't continue on in your sin. It doesn't work that way. Your faith is based on your behavior change. I don't run across Christians or Jews who argue that I can now go do whatever the heck I want to do, whatever I feel like that moment in time, now that I believe in Jesus, now nothing, there's no consequence. No one argues that. That's absurd. Of course there's behaviors we don't do. We don't sleep with anything that walks. We don't go murder people. We don't go steal everything. There's behavior changes we don't do. Impossible to argue the same thing. Yeah, you stop doing these things. You guys aren't homosexual anymore, so quit doing it. Right? And the apostles in Acts 15 had discussed quite extensively. They made their reasoning was very well thought out. They said, okay, these Gentiles come in. They have no knowledge of right and wrong. They're just figuring it out. And they'll point out, well, just get these basic stuff on them. And the apostles argue, and their reasoning, they say, because they're going to learn the laws of Moses in the Shabbat, and they go to Shabbat every week. That's their argument. That's what they say in Acts 15. So they know that these people are coming in, your consequence for your sin is being removed at this moment in time as you're coming in to understand Jesus. But now you're going to learn how to live your life correctly by going to Shabbat every week and learning the laws of Moses, as the apostles all agree that that's the best way of doing things. So they all agreed that they argued with. That's what they argued for, I should say. And that's how the process works. So we know that Jesus was taking the penalty of it, but the responsibility to discontinuing sinning is on us. We still have the responsibility to stop doing the behaviors that caused this wreck to begin with. So that stuff's still there, and the sin doesn't make the sin vanish. It makes a penalty for the sin vanish. You're not paying for it in penalty-wise, but it doesn't undo the past. You can't make something not ever occur. I mean, God probably could, but that's messing with human timelines. I don't know how that works. But we can't do that. So we have this responsibility to change our behaviors. how we live our lives. As Jesus points out in Matthew 5, hey, if I'm doing all this stuff, but if you guys don't change your behavior, you advocate for not following the laws of Moses, well, you can be leased the kingdom of heaven. It's not that you won't be there, you'll just be leased. So your behavior actually matters. So our sins are still our responsibility to stop doing. That's still important. So Joe Schmuel B, he offers his animal, tries to, obviously. And Messiah says, I'm a conscious living spirit now. Taking his blood, I'm applying the blood to Shmuel B's action, whatever Shmuel B was, the penalty for it. That's not an excuse for Shmuel B to go off and go do it again. That's the opposite. Now Shmuel B, now discontinue doing whatever you were doing before. Stop doing it or change something, whatever it is, just change and improve. So Jesus' job, his function, was not to make sin not possible, right? That'd be the next option you have. And the alternate choice you'd have to make sins actually, like sins go away, is make it not possible for you or me as a human being. And I only know that's possible is after we're dead, because we can't do anything more because we're dead. So either Jesus removes the penalty and the sin's still possible, I could still possibly do it. I have to deal with that methodology as being a living, breathing, flesh and blood human being. Or he removes the ability to sin, which is I'm dead, because it's the only way you can do it, and it no longer be flesh. So we have these two options, and I prefer the living part versus the dead part. Most people do. So that transfer is a transfer of penalty for sins. You'll also note the Apostle Paul's discussion matter in Romans, and it's, I think it's two places he talks about it. I don't remember the address off the top of my head. Doesn't matter. He discusses that Jesus is still required to have offerings. Even if he's dead, he's a resurrected being. He's up in heaven. He's sitting right hand of God. He says, but you still have to have offerings. Jesus is still required to give God offerings. They're not sin offerings, but they're still offerings. They're offerings of that we are responsible to bring to Jesus regularly. So this transfer of sin, consequence of sin to Jesus is narrowly focused to sins specifically, the consequence of sins, not other things. Celebratory events, which all the burnt offerings are used, peace offerings are used for, those events are still required because all the apostles did that. They said, yes, this is still the process. It's still important. Jesus is going before God and say, God, look, Shmuel B did a great thing today. Look, he helped some old lady across the street, whatever it is. He did some good thing and praised God for it and said, hey, see God, this is a good person. I'm glad that I applied my blood for Shmuel B because look what a great job he's doing today. Those are good offerings that we give. So those offerings are still required. And so you would want Shmuel B to stay alive so he can keep doing those things and make those choices that are positive, sinless or sin-free, good choices. And the man Messiah is able to continue on being resurrected to continue to apply to Shmuel B's mistakes, because he makes mistakes along the way. We're not perfect. And periodically, he says, I'll cover it again because I know there's more value to Shmuel B than just this one mistake he made. This whole process of transfer is a legal mechanism. So I know it's not critical to one's salvation. That's a gift. But this is just a legal mechanism of how to understand how this process works. If I was talking to a Jewish person who was not believing in Messiah, this is the style of discussion I would use in that method, because it is a legal discussion, and that's really what we're kind of talking about in this process. It's a legal mechanism. I know it's complicated, but complexity is what makes God really cool. Any comments or questions? I took you over time, so I apologize for that.
Yeah, John made an interesting observation that the wave offering and the heave offering, you get the sign of the cross because one goes sideways and one goes up. So he became both of those offerings on the cross.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That could be. I never pictured that one.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.